The recordings are now connected.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to the BC Charter Review Call on May 31st, 2016. On the call today, we have Jay Chapman, Andy Abrams, Justin Olufier, Chris Wilson, Philip Corwin, Jay Sadowski, Paul Mitchell, Arinola Akinyemi, Steve DelBianco, Beth Allegretti, Hiba Hussein, Steve Coates, John Berard, and Angie Graves. We have apologies from Barbara Warner and from staff. We have myself, Chantal Dirksen. I'd like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you ever so much, and over to you, Chris.
Thank you, Chantal, and thanks, everyone, for joining today's call. Of course, this call is devoted solely to reviewing and sort of taking questions on the updated charter as well as the updated membership application form. Hopefully, everyone got a chance to take a look at these documents leading up to today's call and have some questions. I know I have some things I've noticed and so forth, but maybe Andy, if it's okay with you, maybe I just turn to you to sort of provide a very quick general overview of what was done. I know there were a few outstanding comments in the document. Perhaps you can flag those orally for folks, and then we can maybe just turn to questions from individuals and issues that may come up. So maybe, Andy, if it's okay with you, can I turn to you just for a couple minutes?
Sure, Chris, and thank you. And I want to thank all the contributors to the Charter Working Group. I mean, this has been an ongoing project now for about 6 years. The current charter that we have for the BC is from 2009. So thanks to everybody that's contributed. There's been a lot of BC members. I know the latest iteration is special thanks to Phil Corwin and Steve Coates, we've had weekly calls for about the last year and a half or so. ICANN staff has also been incredibly helpful. And so what we've done in this latest iteration is basically ICANN staff has taken what they call a best of breed, because they're in charge of working on all the charters for the various stakeholder groups. And so they've put together sort of a best of breed based on that. And then we've taken that, the original charter for the BC, and then added our own input through all these weekly calls and discussions. So what you see is a result of that. And as I said in my email to the membership, we've essentially revised every provision. And so I'm interested to hear, all of your questions regarding all of the provisions that you have. But we did want to specifically highlight several sections, and we'll probably start with that for individual review and approval by the membership. And the first of those are it's section 2.13 and 2.55. I think everybody has individual scrolling, so they can go to that. And that's actually a provision that that Jimson has been spearheading for some time now, and that's the creation of a new general counsel provision. And I think the primary intent is essentially to facilitate the incorporation of the VC for greater ease of accepting membership dues. Jimson, I don't know if you want to add anything there or if anybody else has any questions on that provision that we want to highlight.
Jimson, do you have anything you wanted to add on regarding the GC section? If not, I could certainly just weigh in. I think the proposed language mirrors exactly what we're speaking. So I think certainly as far as the language is concerned, it looks fine. And, I think it's good to have that there. And we reflects the evolution of the GC position. I think later on, it'll be an iteration of the duties that the GC undertakes, and that also is correct. So at least as far as I'm concerned, that's a good addition.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead, Jason.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, can you hear us, Jimson? I think there's an issue on Jimson's end. So, Andy, maybe why don't we go ahead and move? While Jimson's figuring out his technical issue, why don't you maybe just go ahead again and talk about any other outstanding top of line issues.
Yeah, the next issue that I thought we'd highlight, this is a fairly significant change. So if you go to 5.1.2, this is where we talk about eligibility in 5.1. And then 5.1.2, we list out the criteria that would make you ineligible for membership in the VC. And so previously, there was a 50% financial threshold for interest in a contracted party. And so this is actually one of the earlier changes that we made. This was a previous iteration of this working group. But we reduced the threshold fairly considerably to 10%. I think the notion there was that, you know, previously people were fairly clearly in one stakeholder group or another. And with the new GTLE program, as you know, companies get a little bit more flexible and there are interests in different stakeholder groups, you know, I think that's fine. But we wanted to put sort of a measurable threshold on how much of a financial interest we felt might present a conflict of interest. And so that's where the 10% came from. But to the extent that you know, members have questions or want to discuss that further, we wanted to highlight that, as that was a fairly significant change.
So this is Chris. I guess just look ahead. I just got a quick question about that. Are there any current VC members that are now, if this is to go in effect, become, I guess, ineligible to be a VC member? Have we done that analysis?
You know, I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
That's a good question. You know, I think that when we first came up with this provision, it was several years ago. At that time, I don't believe so, but it might be good to see if there are BC members that have an issue with that. And I think in terms of process, Chris, you know, obviously we have this call, but not a lot of our members are not on the call. I imagine that we do want to present some time in addition to this for email questions and that sort of thing, right?
Yes, I think we should, and I think we, you know, we'll give folks at least another week or so. But by the same token, I think we also don't want to. I know for everyone's sake, we don't want to have this lingering out there for you know, all summer. So I think we certainly after this call continue to sort of keep the window open for, like, if you will, for another week or two. And I think the goal will be to wrap up consideration of this document, you know, by the middle of June. I think that would be my goal. Does that make sense for folks?
That sounds great to me. And Chris, I'll let you be the chair in terms of calling on people. I know a couple people have their hands up.
Okay, yeah. So I see Phil and then Steve. Phil, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. Phil, for the record. On the 10% limit, you know, of course, you know, Andy's from Google and they're, now Alphabet, a major registry operator for new TLDs, but they're not seeing, you know, across their vast revenue base that this 10% of revenue would in any way be triggered by their operations. And I know I see Steve has his hand raised. I discussed this with him, and for a trade association, we wouldn't be attributing any of the revenues of their members to them. It's, you know, they derive their revenues from member dues, so a trade association with some member in it that's a registry operator wouldn't be affected. But, you know, we can get feedback from the BC members, but it was felt that with the homogenization with the new TLD program and the Coming Dot brand that a lower threshold than 50% was needed for the new environment to make sure that BC members we're taking things from a strictly business perspective. But it's open to discussion by the membership. Thanks.
Thanks, Phil. Steve?
Yeah, thanks, Phil, for addressing that point. As a trade association executive director, I appreciated your answer because it would be extremely challenging to go through all of my members' companies and figure out what dollar revenue each of them derived from these operating characteristics and then gross that up for a trade association. I'm not sure I could even get the dollars associated with these contract party activities from each of my member companies. So if Phil's interpretation is right, it looks like 5.1.2b doesn't apply to a trade association that is otherwise qualified. Do I have that right?
That's correct, Steve. This is Andy. Yeah, I mean, if you look at B, it's entities which derive revenue as a registry operator, registrar, et cetera.
Thanks, Andy and Phil. Appreciate all the work you put into this.
Jason, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you. Chris, this is Jason. I hope you can hear me now.
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. I apologize for the quality of service to my network. That's a challenge in our part of the world. So we will overcome it very soon, hopefully. Well, I want to begin by really thanking Andy and the team, Phil. Thank you so much for the tremendous service, and also ICANN staff for all the support provided. It's been a very comprehensive and thorough work you've done, and it raised up the profile of BC in terms of this quality of work that we can see. Just a few comments, though. Though I missed some of the discussion before I have to join back again, to clarify a little more. That is on page 4. Page 4, 2.12 on the screen, when you talk about additional non officer voting member. Additional non officer voting member. And the reference to GNSO Council Representatives. Well, a GNSO Council Representative in the BTS committee. Hello? Yes?
Yes, Jensen, you're breaking up, I think. Can we Chantel have the phone operator call you, please?
Can you hear me?
You're breaking up. It's hard to hear you. So can Chantel have the phone operator call you? Okay, Jensen, Chantel, if you could take care of that, that'd be great so we can get him properly connected, and while that's working, I do have one quick question though, Andy and Phil, about 5.1.2b, and this is, I guess, a devil's advocate question, a clarification, I guess. If a trade association that represents what we deem, what we understand to be sort of primary, the primary line of business is being a registry, and they have, trade association that comes into existence and represents, say, 4 or 5 registry operators, would they be eligible to join the BC, even though their revenue is driven, it just simply comes from membership dues?
And Chris, this is Andy. So we did think of that, and so that's why we have that catch-all provision after E, if you talk about the entity which does not fall within the non-exhaustive criteria. There's still credentials committee discretion to review conflicts issues. And so basically the provision set forth in A, B, C, and D were sort of measurable objective criteria. And then to the extent that something fell outside of that, but the credentials committee still felt that there were significant conflicts issues, that they could still use their discretion. So that was our intent.
Good. Gotcha. Thank you. I appreciate that.
And Phil here, just to add to that, if the DNA applied, we probably wouldn't accept them, given that they're a trade group representing solely contracted parties, pretty much.
Great. Thank you. Okay, I know we're still waiting on is Chantel Jensen connected?
Hi, Chris. Jensen is not connected yet. I will follow up with that.
Okay, thanks. Andy, maybe we'll go ahead and proceed while we work on getting Jensen connected. Although I see Steve, do you have your hand raised?
That's right. I appreciate what Phil just said about 5.1.2e and the paragraph below. Maybe that should be F then. I don't know, but if that discretion is preserved by the Credentials Committee, are we sure that a disgruntlicant wouldn't complain to the ombudsman that we were discriminating by not accepting their membership? And I wonder whether our discretion can be so open, or do we need to indicate in that extra sentence this notion of conflicts? They might be ineligible to be a member based upon a review and a determination with respect to conflicts of interest with the business constituency mission statement. I mean, do we need to lay out why we would use discretion? Or perhaps that's done in Section 5.6. I'll scroll ahead to see.
Yeah, there are a number of provisions, Steve, this is Andy, where we do talk about conflicts, and there is some of that in 5.6, but also, as you talked about, the mission statement, and then 5.1, where we talk about eligibility. So there are a number of criteria that we can use that are certainly that we can refer to. It's not simply out of thin air.
Andy, to that end, I would ask ICANN, since they're helping us with this, to have them and ombudsman or legal quickly review and ask them the question as they review our charter. We could say, would we be immune? Would we be able to withstand a challenge from a trade association comprised of mostly contract parties using the discretion available in 5.6? And if they say, yup, you're in the clear, we'll have that in writing someplace and it will save us a headache later on.
That sounds good. That's a good suggestion, Steve.
Thanks, Steve. Okay, Danny, why don't you go ahead, and while we still wait on Jensen, if you want to go ahead and flag anything else that we should be aware of.
Sure. So the next section that we wanted to highlight relates to weighted voting categories, and that's 5.3.2. So if you go there, 5.3.2, let's see. So these categories are essentially, they're consistent with what we have now in the 2009 charter. We did clarify the language a bit, but we did, because it has been so long since these have been really updated, we did want to flag this for individual review by the membership to just make sure that people didn't have issues that they wanted to raise or questions about this. And so we do have the three categories with one vote, two votes, or three votes, essentially depending on geographic diversity and size of the entity, and that's sort of the main criteria that we used.
Steve, I see your hand raised. Jim, I know you're on the phone bridge. We'll get to you in just a second. Let's wrap this discussion up, and then we'll get to you. So, Steve, go ahead, and I have something to ask, too. Steve, go ahead.
Thanks. Andy, with respect to the phrase in one region, and does based mean, you know, principal place of business and headquarters, or can it mean with extensive operations? Because, as you know, NetChoice has members that most of whom have U.S. headquarters, but nearly all of whom have operations around the world. Do you think that the word based is speaking to headquarters, or is it more broadly interpreted to mean companies that do business around the world?
My understanding is it's headquarters. But this is actually a good question for ICANN, since I know this is based on ICANN criteria for diversity. My understanding is headquarters. I don't know, Phil, if you have a different understanding when we worked on this.
Yeah, I just don't recall a specific discussion, but might be good to nail it down.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very easy for a business to conduct business in multiple countries at this point. If you're online, you're essentially worldwide, and so I think this is intending to be more of a physical base in addition to conducting business.
And yet, Andy, a physical base would mean a physical presence, and companies like yours have physical presence all around the world in more than one ICANN region. But I guess if you use a strict definition of legal headquarters, even Alphabet, Google, only one headquarters. Is that right?
Yeah, no, I mean, there are different headquarters depending on the region. But you're right. I mean, I think if you have a physical office in more than one region, I don't know if you want to get into what literally is a headquarters or not based on a legal definition, because that involves legal interpretation. I mean, I imagine that if you have a fairly large physical presence in multiple jurisdictions, that would apply. I was intending to contrast that with, say you're an internet business and you have sales in other countries.
Right.
I think that probably would not qualify. But if you have a physical office and you have employees on the ground and you have an operations in a region, I don't know that we didn't need to get into whether or not that legally qualifies as a headquarters.
Yeah.
I think that's...
Yeah, so maybe instead of based in, it would say with members with physical presence in more than one ICANN region. With physical presence instead of the word based. It would just ask you to think that over as you discuss it with ICANN.
That's a good suggestion.
Steve Coates?
Steve, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. So I think I remember briefly talking about this, and I think my reasoning was not to get too far into the weeds of defining, what that means. I think that, that particular definition can remain loose and flexible over time. And as Andy alluded to previously, that, defining, getting into legal definitions, based on whether there's a physical presence in a particular geography differs from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And, if one of our members was faced with having to discuss that, that could be problematic in and of itself. It could, raise tax consequences and all that. So I would prefer a more flexible, looser interpretation of that and defer to the member based on their interpretation of that particular clause.
Okay. This is Chris. I guess a question on reading categories specifically one and three together. It seems to me that if there was a business with less than 10 employees but more than $500,000 in revenue, they would slip through the cracks. Am I reading that correctly? I don't know how many companies that exist in that regard, but I guess presumably it's entirely possible that there would be. So I see in category one, we're looking at companies that have both 10 or more employees and annual revenue of at least $500,000. In category three, we have fewer than 10 employees or annual revenue less than $500,000. I wonder if there needs to be instead of and in category one, it should be or vice versa. It seems like there's an opportunity for a company that would, but again, with less than 10 employees and more than $500,000 in revenue, would not meet either of these three or any of these three criteria. Am I misreading that?
Hey, Chris, this is Andy. Yeah, we actually specifically talked about that, and so we addressed that because I think that was actually a hole in the current 2009 charter, because I think in category one it used to say or, and so we did change that to and. So basically, in order to meet the criteria for category one, You have to meet both criteria. So you have to have more than 10 employees, and you have to have revenue of more than $500,000. If you only meet one of those two, then you fall back into category one, category three as opposed to category one. And so category three, basically, if you fail to meet the more than 10 or more than $500,000, either one of those, then you're in category three. Does that make sense? So. Say you have revenues of $1 million, but you only have two employees, so that meets the or criteria for category three, but you don't qualify for category one.
Okay. I see what you're saying. Okay, good. Steve Coates, is your hand still raised, or is that a
Yeah, I think, Chris, I think you raise a good point, but I think the number of people who had fallen in that hole are probably pretty far and few between. I think there were a number of years that Twitter would not qualify, given that they had no revenue, but, you know, I see your point.
But seemingly, I guess the question is then, is there a hole there or is there not a hole there?
I don't think there is. I think there used to be. I don't think there is. I think you either meet both money and employees, or if you meet only one, then you're back down to Category 3.
Okay. Okay. Before I move on, any other questions on this particular comment? If not, I can turn back to Jensen. Okay, actually, I see Jay Chapman has a question. Jay asks, why is the change from or to and in Category 1?
Okay. I can try to explain that again. So basically, there would be a hole if there was an or, right? If you didn't meet both categories. So now we changed it to and. And so if you have more than 10 employees and have more than $500,000 in annual revenue, then you meet Category 1. But if you don't meet one of those, so like I said in the example where you make, you know, $1 million in revenue but only have two employees, then you would no longer meet Category 1 because it's not an or, it's an and then you would fall back into Category 3. That didn't used to be the case, and I think it was a bit confusing because I think there used to be a hole, and so we tried to close that here, and so hopefully that this is an improvement.
Right. Jay, is that, you understand? Is that, I know Jay's not on the phone, but.
Oh, okay.
he's in the chat room. So Jay asks, so the reason is to close a hole. I think that's the answer is yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, Jay, the answer is yes. Okay. Any further questions or comments on this particular issue? Okay, maybe Andy, before you go on, Jensen, I think you're on connected now. So do you want to go ahead and raise the question you were raising before? I'm sorry for the delay.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. This is Jensen. I'm sorry about the break in transmission. Well, I'm happy I'm connected back. Well, I would like to commend Andy and the team, Phil, for the great job they've done. It's quite an excellent output after long, tedious time. And the quality is high. I just have this observation on the section 2.12, talking about additional non-officer voting member. Additional non-officer voting member with reference to GNSO council representative. The GNSO council representatives, they are also officers of the BC. They also participate in ESCOM votes. So I think that could be additional voting officer, you mean? I need that clarified. We want to respond to that now.
Andy? Or Steve or Phil?
Is that right? That must have been taken from the previous charter. I don't remember changing that up, but we can look into that.
Yeah, 2.12. So I'm suggesting it should be additional voting officer, just additional officer. At least from all my experience, the councillors have always participated actively in the ESCOM, and so maybe it's referring to additional voting officer. And I also would like to commend the inclusion of the non-voting officer, that general counsel. So that takes care of the request by our general counsel for that to be recognized in our charter. It's going forward with the registration of EIN. Okay, and if I may also contribute on the issue of geographic diversity, I think it's quite tenable that a global corporation, for example, based in Nigeria, employs Nigerian say employees and have those employees participate in some activity. I think it also serves that region, you know, in a way. Yes, it does serve it. So I look at it that way. Also, in addition to maybe indigenous registered organization that is based from another, from that diverse region, is still tenable. So I don't have any objection to that reading or point of view. Okay, apart from that, I think I'm okay with it. It's a very good output. And I don't know, maybe we have discussed when we could adopt this, because, the, as I said, the council, general council, is awaiting approval of this charter by the members for him to conclude the process of registering BC as a not-for-profit organization. Thank you.
Thank you, Jimson. I'll look into that 2.1.2.
Yeah, and just this is Chris. Just to your point, I think the goal would be after this call, if there's edits to be made, or you know, if there's issues that need to be resolved, they'll be resolved. Edits will be made. I guess we will recirculate. I would consider to be, I guess, the final draft, and then give members maybe a couple more weeks to look at it, and then we tie it up and we vote it up or down, and then we move on. So I think we'll get that done hopefully in the next couple weeks. Maybe 3 weeks at most, but ideally we get this done before Helsinki. I think that would be the end of the road for, I think, we want to go as long as that. I think, so that would be my suggestion. I can certainly talk to XCOM about that as well and get their input, but that would be my thinking. Steve, I see your hand raised.
Thank you. This is in reference to what Jimson suggested on the executive committee composition. This is in 2.1. So the executive committee composition, the reason that those words are in there, a non-officer voting member, is that the counselors are not officers per se, but they are members of the executive committee. So the counselors are referenced in this document as counselors, and the four elected officers are referenced as officers. So Jimson, I do think 2.1.2 is consistent with current practice, in that the counselors are non-officers, oh, but they're also part of the executive committee. And Jimson, I would ask you to see if that explanation is satisfactory, because I don't want to send Andy off into an investigation if it was really just a different way of understanding it. Thank you.
Okay, yeah, thank you, Steve. I think it's clearer now. Yeah, I get it. That's okay. That's okay with me now. Thank you, Steve, for the clarification.
Great. Thank you. Okay, Andy, go ahead if you want.
Great. Thank you, Steve. That's yeah. Helpful. The next highlighted section is 6.3.2C. And if you look at 6.3.2, this is essentially discussing the process for coming together on a BC policy position. We generally come together on policy positions by consensus, and so we did want to formalize if there was going to be a minority position, and so we did submit a 10% threshold for raising a vote on a minority BC position. And then if consensus can't be reached, there would be a vote, and then there would be a BC position. But if there was still a 10% of more of the membership holding an alternative view, then the thinking of the drafting team was that it would be noted as such in the public comment. And so we would have formal notation in public comments of alternative positions if it's a 10% or more threshold is met. Because this is sort of new, it was never really formalized before. We did want to highlight that for the membership.
So this is, I see, Steve, go ahead. I see your hand. Steve?
Thank you, Chris. And as the person who's shepherded this process over the last several years, I believe this would be an improvement. The current charter indicated that if 10% of the members simply objected to a comment, we would have to go into a voting situation on whether to approve the comment. This is more constructive in the sense that people aren't going to be able to stop a comment, but rather have to present an alternative. So the alternative formulation is a very constructive way forward, because it either results in the majority supporting the original comment or the inclusion of a minority statement at 10%. So I think that I think this is a very significant improvement. We'll probably discover ways in which it's difficult to execute from time to time, but I think this is better than the current go, no-go decision because it includes an alternative. So thanks for including this, and I hope it works.
Thanks, Steve. Yeah, we had a lot of discussion with a lot of lawyers on the call, and we felt that the original language was more akin to sort of a filibuster where a small group could essentially hold up a BC position, and as you said, our preference was to not let that happen, but instead to have a minority position.
And this is Chris. Just quick clarification. It's 10% of the entire membership, not 10% of, I guess, members that vote on the document or position.
That's correct. It's a fairly big threshold because it's 10% of the entire membership, whether or not people vote.
Great. Thanks.
And with today's numbers, that's 5 members.
Okay, currently 6 members.
Any other questions on this issue or thoughts? Okay. Andy, go ahead.
Yeah, the final element that we wanted to highlight for individual review was that there's a separate document, which is the new BC application and eligibility form. And so it's essentially an update of the original application form, but we did want to add more of the eligibility criteria in there, as opposed to having sort of a separate statement of interest. It's sort of an all-inclusive. So if members take a look at that, the notion is that this is supposed to be updated whenever significant changes are made, but also once a year. And we thought maybe a good time to do that would be, you know, upon payment of dues, that timing. But to really sort of update this as a continued statement of interest and eligibility on at least a once a year basis.
This is Chris. One suggestion would maybe you think about adding to the affirmations just a specific affirmation that the applicant acknowledges that they are not representing any government. I know that was part of the that's within the charter itself, and I know there's in affirmation 4 they agree to abide by the charter. So I guess by indirectly they're acknowledging that they don't represent. But it might be good just to have it as a separate affirmation. So there's no confusion potentially, but I leave that. If others think otherwise, that's fine. But that's just a suggestion from my end, just to make it clear for applicants.
Yeah, I think that's a good suggestion. Thanks, Chris.
Jensen, your hand's raised.
Yes. Thank you. This is Jensen. Thank you, Andy, for looking at this. This is good, but we do have something on the online right now, which will come on stream down the line, and it's the same kind of format. So we'll adjust some things there, like what's the affirmation, as Chris has mentioned. We'll adjust that on the online portal through the members click that we're using. So, but then with regard to the individual membership information, they can do that at any time during their membership, even with the pictures uploaded, as case may be. So in essence, I'm saying that this is okay and very much in line with what we have online for online application right now. So, but with some little amendments, which we are currently making. So this is quite okay. But members can always do review year-round. You can do review year-round. And there's also a proviso to indicate that the application is subject to the review by the credential committee. And then and you'll get a feedback within 14 days or thereabout. So I think a time frame when they should expect the feedback is something that I think would be good to add. So the amendment you are looking at is, as you have said, Chris, for government, that the person is not working for government, and then to say that the credential committee will be reviewing this and will get the feedback within 14 days. So that will be added to the online portal. Thank you.
Thank you, Jensen.
And Chris, this is all I have for sections that we wanted to specifically highlight. And so I, at this point, just open it up for any questions on any provisions.
Terrific. Steve, I see your hand raised.
Thanks. Looking at the form caused me to review that phrase as a registry operator, registrar, reseller, or otherwise related to domain name supply. And then you use the clarifying expression collectively, comma, contracted parties. Are we aware of companies that are in a business that is related, otherwise related to domain name supply, that are not contract parties? And if so, are we seeking to cover that here, or are we only looking at parties that are in the contract chain, like you said, a reseller, registrar, or registry operator? So the phrase otherwise related to domain name supply, if that doesn't extend beyond the circle of contracted parties, then it is a little bit of a ambiguous phrase. And I don't even know of a company that might get picked up as part of the domain name supply chain that isn't also a contract party. But I'm looking for some clarification there.
That's a good question, Steve. And is your question whether we should revise the defined term or actually revise the category to remove domain name supply?
Yeah, Andy, if the drafters of the new charter and the membership meant for this to just be contracted parties, including resellers, then that would be clearer if we dropped otherwise related to domain name supply. In other words, let's make it as clear as we can, because there may be in the future certain things that are done in the notion of domain name supply. A company that is a broker, for instance, and tries to arrange for the transfer of domain names from one entity to another, they're not a contracted party, but they are sort of related to domain name supply.
No, that's a good point. I think the point is to avoid conflicts with contracted party interests. So if that seems overbroad, then I think we can look into removing that last phrase.
Thank you.
and this is Chris. I think, I mean, that because I don't think that phrase is in charter.
Yeah, five. It is. It's in 512B, and so if we decided to shorten it, we would do it both places.
Okay. Okay. All right. Open the floor. First, Andy, thanks very much for going through all that. I appreciate that. Open floor for folks. If there are any other questions or issues that have not been addressed so far on this call. This is Chris. Not hearing any. Oh, I see Jameson. Jameson, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Chris. This is Jameson. Not necessarily with regard to any issue yet to be tackled. Just for information. I did say before that by the end of business today, the invoices will go out through the portal, through the members click. But we're having some little glitches, and we are addressing them now. So just to say that the invoices might not be going out today, and we are hopeful that the next few days we'll be able to resolve those glitches with member clicks help team, and then we'll be able to start using the portal. The modification we also discussed on the application form, we'll try to append that as well, and then maybe wait for Andy to wrap up the five section, the review of the 5-4. So just as to provide that information, that the invoices might not come today, maybe another few days, depending when we'll resolve some glitches we have. Thank you.
Thank you, Jameson. So this is just one. I just have a couple, I guess, things I flagged for just clarification. It may just be me personally, but I'm looking at, this is Chris, I'm looking at 2.3.2 regarding executive committee term limits. I assume, and this is, I mean, an officer may be elected for up to three consecutive terms in one position, but no more than five consecutive years in any EC position with exceptions granted when no other candidates exist. So I'm reading that as to say no more than 5 years total as an executive committee member, unless there's no other candidate. Is that correct reading?
Well, it says no more than five consecutive years.
Consecutive years, okay. I see. Okay.
Yeah, so I guess you can take a break and come back later on.
Others have questions or issues? I think.
Chris, I would just ask, are we going to add the word consecutive then to that phrase?
I think it is. I think it is, Steve, in there actually. So I just didn't read it carefully enough to see that word is in there. But it does say consecutive.
So, Chris, I have on my my action items list a check with the ICANN ombudsman regarding potential challenge to the non-eligibility criteria, looking into the contracted party's definition to likely remove the domain name supply phrase, adding in the statement of eligibility or the application, basically an affirmation that you do not represent a government, and then getting back to you and the membership for ratification. Does that sound right?
That does sound right. I may have a couple of quick things to add, but I see, Jensen, is your hand still raised or is that an old hand? Is that a new hand?
Yes, Chris, thank you. Just to affirm one of the provisions that with regard to committees, ad hoc committees, or temporary or permanent committees, that the chair will have to rotate maybe at the end of 1 year. Correct, Andy?
I'm sorry, can you ask that question again?
Yes, there is a provision with regard to committees, that is ad hoc committees, temporary or permanent committees, that they will have a chair, and then at the end of each year, the chair will have to rotate. Is that correct?
Is that in a particular provision, the ad hoc committees? I know that's in the, let's see.
Yes, like 9.4 there above. Let me see, I hope I'm saying well.
Yeah, there's an outreach section in 9, and then that. I don't know
Anyway, I think it wasn't a bad update, really. Just trying to spot the exact location that each committee or other committee chair will have to change at the end of each year, you know, something like that. I'm sorry, I can't leave my hands on it right now, but I saw a provision with that. Just to say it, well, it could just to raise it, you know, for awareness.
Okay, yeah. In terms of the formal committees, obviously there are provisions, but with the ad hoc committees, I don't think there's any formal language in there about term limits for chairs.
Okay, I'm sorry. Maybe when I say it again, I could send it to the list.
Thank you, Jensen. I guess actually maybe that's a good segue. I'm looking at Section 4.0, other committees. I see we have general provisions. Then we have credentials committee and finance committee. I know we have an outreach committee. Maybe that's my own ignorance. But is outreach not a formal committee that would be otherwise constituted under 4.0? I know we referenced it later in the charter, but is there a reason? What am I missing, I guess, with regard to why is outreach different than finance and credentials?
Yeah, that's correct. Outreach is in Section 9, so it has a whole section devoted to it. We talked about it as a drafting team, and we decided that outreach is sort of a general ongoing goal of the BC, and you know, and as needed, committees will be set up. There'll be different projects and that sort of thing. But we decided not to include it as sort of a standing committee, as the finance committee is, and that sort of thing. We wanted more flexibility there.
Okay, thank you. I guess maybe that begs the question: is there a process in the charter? I mean, if the BC decided they wanted to stand up another formal committee of some way, shape, or form, I guess they could just do so using 4.0.1, just the general procedures. And
correct. And also, you would have to amend the charter again. But that you know, you would just amend the charter to add another committee to it. And I will note that is one thing that has changed as well. So under the 2009 charter, the threshold to amend the charter is a majority vote. And so for this new charter, further amendments to this new charter will require a two-thirds vote. We wanted to up the threshold a bit for any further changes to the charter.
And that's two-thirds of all members, not just voting members, not just members that are voting. Is that right? Hello? Can folks hear me?
Yes.
Is Andy, can you hear me?
Hi, Chris. This is Chantal.
Chris, I hear you.
Andy Abrams was disconnected. We are calling him back.
Okay. Thanks. I know we're approaching the top of the hour, so I don't want to belabor this, but if we get Andy back on real quick. And I see
Hello, sorry, this is Andy. I just got dropped off the call for some reason. I apologize.
No, sure. I guess the question, I don't know if you got my question, but the question was with regard to amending the charter, the two-thirds threshold apply, is it applicable to the entire membership, or is it applicable to those members that voted, the voting pool?
It's of members, all members.
All members, okay. Jensen, I see your hand raised, and I know we've got just a few more minutes.
Yes, I got that location now on 4.11, where we talk about chair's responsibility. The members of each committee shall elect a chair annually who, among other duties mentioned elsewhere in this charter, will. So that's what I was just saying, that or any committee set up annually, they will need to have a change of chair, as the case may be. 4.11. Yeah. Andy?
Okay, I just got to 4.11, and right again. I mean, this relates to committees that are formal standing committees. I think it would not technically apply to ad hoc committees, and so I think that's intended to be more flexible for standing committees. That would obviously apply.
Okay. So maybe like outreach committee, credentials committee, right? Or finance committee. No, it doesn't apply to finance committee.
No, I think it does. It would not apply to outreach, Jensen, but I think it would apply to finance and credentials because those are standing committees.
That's correct.
Yeah, but the vice chair of finance and operation is the chair of the finance committee.
But I think that, I mean, I don't know, I'll let Andy answer. My understanding is that's not inconsistent with what, I mean, each committee shall elect the chair, presumably using their process. And I guess if the outreach committee, excuse me, the finance committee deems the vice chair for finance to be the chair, then I guess that's the process. I mean, it doesn't go into detail exactly how that happens, right? Is that correct, Andy?
Yeah, no, that's correct. I don't think it's inconsistent.
Yeah. Jensen, is that okay? You understand? Does that make sense?
Yes. I understand that. Like, for example, the credential committee and the outreach committee, I think it could readily apply to those ones. But statutorily, the vice chair of finance operation is the, according to the charter, the chair of the finance committee. And then maybe quickly now, let me clarify on 4.32, that the finance committee shall be comprised of three business constituency members. Is that inclusive of the vice chair, finance and operation, or exclusive?
Composition?
Yes. The finance committee, say three members, is it exclusive or inclusive of vice chair, finance, and operation?
It just says it should be comprised of three business constituency members, so I think it should be inclusive.
So we may, this is Chris, we may,
so if we have a vice chair, finance, and operation, there is only two people, as it's composed right now. Like Angie and Chris, they are the members along with me. So that means making all together three. So it's only about two voting opportunities we could have maybe towards the end of the year, apart from the officer's election for the vice chair in national operation.
Okay.
So So Andy, I see Phil's hands raised, but maybe I'll just turn to the – I know that Steve DelBianco referenced it too, I think. Jensen's point maybe to make it more clear that the vice chair of finance per the charter is the de facto chair of the finance committee, so to sort of provide further clarity on that. And maybe it's worth for members – maybe worth flagging and thinking about whether the 3BC member threshold for composition would be exclusive of the chair. I don't know if that raises concerns. Phil, do you have your hand raised on this issue?
Well, on the issue of the chairman of the Finance Committee, the general rules of interpretation are that the specific overrides the general, so the specific designation in 2.5.2A that the vice chair for finance and operation chairs the Finance Committee would overrule the other one. We could write an explicit exception in the other place, but I don't think there's a real interpretation issue here.
I agree, Phil. I don't think it hurts to clarify, and so thank you, Jimson, for raising that point, and so I'm happy to do it.
So just to Jimson's lag, his other point is it worth considering, I don't know if it throws things out of kilter, but if the fact that because of the unique relationship of the vice chair for finance and outreach being the de facto chair of the finance committee, would that then make more sense to have that person being considered exclusive of the three business members, BC members, as composition? My inclination is I think it'd be helpful to have the opportunity for at least three BC members, not including the chair, to be part of the committee, just to be a little more over-inclusive than under-inclusive. But I don't know if that's going to affect, if that disenfranchises, if you will, the credentials committee, if they're beholden to three. I mean, it's a little different, I guess, because there's no de facto chair of the credentials committee. But I'd be open to considering three members plus a chair for each committee, credentials and finance, if that makes sense for folks.
Yeah, that makes sense. This is Andy, and I'm seeing from the chat that it seems like, at least for the people on this call, there seems to be some consensus there. So I think that makes sense to have three plus the chair.
Great. Thank you. Any other thoughts, concerns, questions from folks? I know we're past the hour here, but I think we've covered a lot of good ground. Steve got the question in the chat room. Do we need odd number of members that votes will be decisive?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. And Steve's continuing to type. So a three member or five, okay. Yeah. So maybe we would do
three or five. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe we do chair plus
chair plus
four.
Two or chair plus four.
Yeah, okay. I say just chair plus four to be, to be a little more inclusive, I guess. If there's interest, we wouldn't want to foreclose people joining. That would be my suggestion. Perhaps we can, maybe that's something we can, Andy, you can add in there and then flag. Jensen suggests five, but we can have. Do we want to go ahead and just decide on this call, maybe, rather than have it? Is anyone opposed, I guess, to making it chair plus four, so total members of total of five for each credentials and finance committee? I don't see any opposition to that. So my suggestion would be to change it to that effect. You can flag it, and if folks do have others that aren't on the call have concerns, then we can readdress. But I think we can just – I suggest making that edit and then flagging it for folks.
That sounds great. I can flag all the changes that we made on the call for when you send the final back around.
And then real quick, last thing on communication web presence. Do we want to list, among other things, 7.11, these particular committees, the standing committees, and even outreach for that matter? Just list the – I mean, I don't know if we have to put it in the charter necessarily. It's maybe just something you can just do ad hoc, but – I don't know if we have – if you go on our website, I don't know if you can see who's on the Credentials Committee, the Finance Committee, and the Outreach, the Informal Outreach Committee. But it may make sense to to have that on the page. And then maybe something, Jensen, we can just talk about offline. I don't know if it has to be listed as far as 7.11 or not, but it just occurred to me that I don't think we have that on the page, and I think it might be helpful for folks, especially with regard to outreach, if there's prospective members, they would know who to look to perhaps first. But Jensen, maybe we'll just go ahead and why don't we just leave it as is with regard to the charter, but Jensen, I can talk to you offline about that, and maybe we can update the page to include that information as well.
In the new website, we have up to C, but the D is what we don't have now. But the information will be right there at the back end. You can access the website and others. And really, I think what matters the most, if I may say, is the organization. You know, organization is the member. So I don't know if for clarification this needs to be there. Well, we can add that, you know, to it.
Okay. I see Chantal's recognizing that there's the leadership info is under responsibilities. But yeah, I think maybe we do want to think about reformatting. But that's a question, that's an issue we don't have to have on this call. I have no more issues or clarifications. Anyone else have concerns, questions, clarifications? I see Steve is typing. I think if not, then thank you. Yes, again, thank you all. Thank you, Andy. Thank you, Phil, Steve Coates, Andrew Harris, who's not on the call, but I know participated on this, and those that aren't here or with us now that helped put this all together. I guess, Andy, we look forward to receiving sort of, I guess, a revised draft with flagged edits, maybe if possible by the end of the week. Because of holiday and stuff, I'll give members a couple of weeks to look at that, and then we'll tackle it, vote on it up or down after that. We'll set up a time to do that. I'll talk to XCOM about that process, but we'll have this finalized before Helsinki, before we all leave for Helsinki. Okay. All right. Well, thank you all very much. Have a great rest of your day, and we will talk to you all soon. Thank you again, Andy. Appreciate it.